Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnops, and this is the February Room.
Just when I think that it's all been done, I visit a local fly shop or discover some new website and browse through the latest fly innovations. Lately, it seems we're in sort of a renaissance period in terms of fly design, and this is especially true for streamer patterns. Fly tires are perfecting the balance between fly movement and castability, resulting in a higher percentage of hookups on those really hard to come by fish like big browns and muskies. My guest today is one such fly innovator, and the name of his company alone smells like the pursuit of big fish. Dan Saltow, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me this morning. It's great to be here, and I'm excited to discuss some of these fun things in going on in fly fishing and fly tying.
All right. Well, great, man. Well, we were introduced by one of our previous guests, Brett Weddington, and I am really looking forward to getting to know a little more about you and your business. But first of all, a fishing story, please.
Well, let's have a little fishing story here. And it's kind of one, you know, that circles back big picture. And how I got into fishing, you know, I was fortunate as far as both sides of my family being outdoorsy, and my dad's side of the family had a pretty long history in fly fishing, albeit it skipped a little bit of a generation or two. But love for the outdoors, and I've been very fortunate to spend a lot of time outside and fishing and all over the place. And I started fly tying when I was really little, more as just something fun to do with my grandfather, and we'd make a big mess and all that, and didn't get into the fishing until later. But I really got the hook to spend time on the water and learn about baits and flies and presentations and all those concepts that transcend the type of fishing you're doing, whether it's fly fishing or conventional tackle. But I had an early love for bass fishing down here in Texas. When I'd visit my mom's side of the family, we'd go bass fishing, and it could be a farm pond or a big famous lake. And I have a distinct memory of, you know, learning about all these baits and techniques and people, you know, boats going 70 with the glitter paint. And, you know, it's was pretty wild. When you're young, you know, that stuff's, you know, you're really excited about it. And I started learning more about baits and what I like to fish, and, you know, really, really love bass fishing. Now, I was living in Seattle, grew up there, loves Western Washington. It's not exactly the bass fishing capital of the United States, but I really, really loved all the different variables and presentations and stuff that you see on, you know, with bass fishing, whether it's on a competitive level or whether it's just going out to fish. And I can remember this as clear as day, and I was probably 8 or 9 years old fishing on Lake Fork, which is essentially, I would compare it to something like the Missouri and Montana, the North Platte. It's basically a hub. You can make the argument that it's the best bass lake in the country. It was ranked that last year. I remember being out there early in the morning, sun on the horizon, and was using the bait caster, which is what my preferred technique was. And I remember, and I was fishing a football head jig, which is something I've emulated in some of my fly designs, in the broad profile that those create. And I fired that jig up into the shallows and just started reeling at a full retrieve. And I came tight and immediately saw, you know, the flash of a big bass, and that connection, you know, without anything in between, was something I'm not going to be forgetting. And it was really fun. And as I was lucky enough to start having opportunities to go fly fishing elsewhere, that same energy that I had to learn about what type of baits to use when bass fishing, I started to understand, and I could apply that to entomology and learning about trout and salmon and steelhead. And by the time I was 15, I had started working for an amazing fly shop in Western Washington called Creekside Angling. And it really spiraled off of that one connection that I really don't, you know, can't imagine ever forgetting and coming tight to that big bass. It was my first big hog, a 6.5 pounder. And really fun fishing story. And now that I'm back here in Texas and in such an awesome community of anglers, it's pretty cool to look back on that, you know, after 15 seasons in Montana to come back to kind of my first love.
Yeah. Now, do you go back out to Lake Fork and fly fish out there? Or is that still a place where you primarily conventional fish? I've fished it before, and we didn't have a lot of success. I think we caught a couple smaller bass, but it's one of those places, right, that you've always heard about, and cast can bring the fish of a lifetime, like that one that you caught that stuck with you.
You know, it's hallowed ground down there, and it has been since it opened, to this day, the best bass fishing I've ever had was on Lake Fork with a fly rod fishing poppers. And that was with one of my longtime buddies, Rob Woodruff, as a guide. He now is in Arkansas, but he guided fly rod anglers on Lake Fork for almost 20 years. And
that's the guy we fished with, man.
Yeah. So, and there you go.
cool. Yeah. This was a long time ago. Okay. Go ahead. Sorry. That's cool.
That's great. Rob, as a talk about going from the frying pan right into the fryer. I mean, asking for such a challenge to put anglers on big bass on Lake Fork, you know, the pressure and the traffic and the sheer volume of the lake is a challenge. And I have a ton of respect for him, and his fly designs are still unlike anything I've ever seen anywhere else. He was very creative, and he taught me a lot of just picking up and talking flies with him. He was pointing out stuff that a lot of bass anglers with conventional tackle are more aware than fly anglers and fly tires. But, Lake Fork is still one of the best, if not the best, lakes in the country. Fly fishing, when you can target fish in the top couple feet of the water column, a fly rod can just be a better tool than the conventional tackle. And I've had the luck to have fortune shine down on me a few times on Lake Fork when they were feeding on the surface. And probably in 20 days of fishing it with conventional tackle, we had a lot of tough days. You know, we never really had a great day. Like, we fished with guides, we fished with friends. I caught that 6.5 pounder. I'll never forget it. But that was a 1 or 2 fish morning, maybe. And then we go out with Rob a few times and we hit it right. And, you know, we caught more bass over 4, 5, 6 pounds in that morning than I've caught since, including Mexico and Florida. And
wow,
you know, and we were surrounded by tournament anglers and bass guides, and we were putting on a clinic over there. And you know, with largemouth, there's something special when they feed on top water. They have the ability, you know, they play chess with you. You know where they're at, and you have to get them out of there. And That's a little different than what we're used to in the trout world, where trout are more migratory and are more willing to chase, and steelhead and salmon, obviously migratory. You're intercepting them during a spawning run or whatever it may be. Bass, no, you see the tree in the water that's got 100 limbs and more snags than you can dream of, and you know that's where that big mama bass is at, right there in that tree. And you got to figure out how to get her to eat and come out of there. And that's a really fun aspect that I really enjoy, because it's very visual, but you're very rarely are you sight fishing. So the element of surprise is just to the roof with bass fishing. And I think other fisheries certainly can rival at times, but overall, it's, you know, fishing for largemouth bass on the surface is as good as it gets for me. Places, you know, whether it's a farm pond or a ditch, or Lake Fork, or I got a chance to fish some amazing places in Central Florida this summer that were, while we, you know, basically you're fishing in the home waters of the Florida strain largemouth, So that's pretty cool. But the fisheries themselves were, you almost couldn't have designed a better fishery for fly fishing. You know, deep water is 7 or 8 feet. And, you know, whereas in the summertime on Lake Fork, you know, you're, a lot of people are fishing 20, 30 feet deep.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool to go around and fish these other bass fisheries. And, you know, and when you meet somebody who has also decided to, you know, take on the challenge of largemouth on a fly rod, it's really fun because there's something about it that's, it's not necessarily that you're going against the grain, but it's definitely a test in patience. When they don't want to feed on the surface, you just have to be, you know, you got to be patient. You can go down a little bit, but when they do want to feed on the surface, there's no better way to do it than with a fly rod.
Yeah, agreed, man. I would almost rather throw top water for bass than just about anything else. In freshwater, you know, it's hard to beat the eat of a bass. Is Rob Woodruff, is he still guiding? Because I want to say that we went fishing with him like in 2010 or something like that. Maybe even before that, maybe 2008. It was a long time ago.
Yeah. So Rob is, he lives in Norfolk, Arkansas, and he relocated up there last year. And he is, this year, I know he's taking a lot of, he takes a lot of pride in knowing the fisheries. And I know he knew them well prior, but I know he's been spending a ton of time on the water and really getting to learn the ins and outs of those tailwaters, both for trout, but also there's a ton of great smallmouth fishing up there. And I haven't been able to get up there yet and fish with him and his wife, Ginny. They rock. They're awesome. And they both guide. And that was a big deal. And they're, so he is 100% in the industry and he's really excited about those fisheries up there. You know, Lake Fork is as busy as it was back in the heyday. It's almost unfathomably busy now. I was out there all last summer and it's not uncommon to have 2,000 to 3,000 boats on the lake in one day.
Jeez.
And that's hard to really comprehend, right? You know, until you see it and you see the volume, you know, and having 1, 2, 3 tournaments on the lake in the same day, it's just a different world. And, you know, the market with Dallas here is so big. There's so many folks who love to go fishing. And, not, you know, you have, they've created, that lake has essentially been its own, you know, economy and culture out there. It's a legendary place, and we see that in on the we see that in places in Montana where the fisheries themselves are the lifeblood of the community.
Sure.
And even if people aren't directly or even cognizant of it, their job, their career is directly impacted by that fishery's health and ability to draw in people. Whether they're local or whether they're, you know, traveling from Japan or something like that.
So, with that boon, are you seeing, you know, more folks taking up the fly rod on Lake Fork, or is it primarily still a conventional tackle fishery?
Well, I mean, we're talking about 99%, but I think there are more. There's undoubtedly more fly anglers out there now than, you know, than there ever has been. There's a lot of the community in Texas of fly anglers is very intertwined and connected in a different way than out west, where I think the abundance of good fishing, whether it's on the west coast itself or the Rockies, you know, people, the fishing's just so good, people just go fishing. And down here, spend a lot of time at working with the local fly fishing clubs, and each city and region will often have a group of anglers who have formed a club to come together, and we'll have a meeting once a month, such as Dallas Fly Fishers, Fort Worth Fly Fishers, Red River Fly Fishers, Lone Star Fly Fishers. And these are all like-minded individuals who, some of them fish a lot and some of them don't fish as much, and some just like to BS and be there for the time. And they have a, you know, they've put together a bass fishing tournament on Lake Fork that goes really well. And there's a few of those around Texas, and it's lighthearted. There, you know, a lot of it's either, you know, they usually break it into divisions of motorized versus non-motorized. And so, and a lot more conventional tackle anglers are understanding the advantages of a fly even if they don't know how to fly fish. When you fish a lot and you learn how you like your baits to move and what kind of things you want to accomplish with your bait or your fly, you eventually speak the same language, even if it's a fly angler talking to a conventional angler, especially in the streamer world. You know, when you're in Montana, you can certainly fish your entire, you fish your whole life just fishing dry flies and nymphs, and not even be aware of the predator side of things in the river, or maybe you just don't like to. It's totally cool. But when you start learning how to make your fly swim and what tends to get the reactions that make your heart beat, you start to really learn, and then you know, from the fly tying perspective, you're looking to build a fly that fits all those boxes, you know, and you're constantly tinkering with materials, tweaking designs. I know, like this year, I have a fly that I came up, the first one I ever tied was at Slide In at the bench, and I wanted a bait fish that walked like a Zara Spook, which is, you know, kind of one of the top two or three iconic bass baits for top water. And it's a bait that moves within the water surface without creating a splash. And it's a deadly tactic, because predators love to trap their bait on the surface and use that as a wall. And the foam-headed bait fish, which is called the Wet Bandit, that was my first fly with Rainey's, and that's thanks to the crew at Slide In and getting me in the door with Rainey's Fly Company. And especially on the Madison, which is broad and shallow, the fish really like to use the surface. You can, if they're feeding actively, you're going to be able to get those big browns to come up and show themselves on the surface, because it's what they're used to doing. And likewise with bass, you know, that fly itself, and I have a few different variations of it now that kind of accomplish different profiles and stuff. But to this day, I'm yet to really run into a concept that is as effective as getting bass or browns or whatever it is to come up and eat on the surface. And it's been a fly that's caught, you know, all manners of stuff in salt water and fresh water. And it's fun to connect those dots. I think my being so into bass fishing growing up and learning about all the baits and soft plastics and different types of crankbaits, you know, that's the approach I took to fly tying when I got into learning how to tie streamers. And for a few years, I was still fishing, you know, fishing your bugs and fishing Kelly's stuff and Johnny's stuff. And, I carried more bugger beasts than I can even think about in the boat. You know, I had six or seven of everything and every color, you know. When I've established where I thought there was some gaps that I really wanted to work on, which, for instance, the sculpin, which is a really big, broad bait fish that is essentially the kind of the number one menu item. It's the proverbial ribeye for big trout in the North Rockies. And there's a few fisheries that don't have as many sculpin, but for the most part, you're going to do well if you fish a sculpin, whether it's an olive woolly bugger or something more precise, or, you know, the classic woolhead sculpin. But one of the kind of trademarks about sculpin flies, whether they're something that was tied 50 years ago or something that's tied, you know, just came out of somebody's vise, is that they typically are bulky and difficult to cast. And yeah, I looked at, you know, the really good flies out there, the ones that have transcended generation, clousers, deceivers, woolly buggers, small minnow patterns, all of them user friendly. Like, they all have that ability to, you can get the fly in the water.
Right.
That's so important. The fly itself is the last thing. There's so much more before that happens to catch a fish. Like, if you try to outfish an olive woolly bugger, like, good luck, man. I just, like, you can only try. And now, are there times when you want a bigger olive woolly bugger, you want more action, you know, that's where we've, you know, like, you're the Space Invader is basically a woolly bugger on steroids. It's got rubber legs coming off of it, barred ostrich.
Exactly.
And especially, like, and when I started learning, when I was at River's Edge, and at the time they were one of the larger, maybe the largest outfitter in the state, out of Bozeman, I was learning from some of the legendary fishing guides, and the amount of brown and olive woolly buggers those guys used was it wasn't necessarily the other end of the spectrum, but they caught a lot of big fish, and they were very particular about how their buggers were tied. And being a shop that at the time was owned by guides, you know, who had guided there for years and guided on the Madison out of West Yellowstone for years, they were particular. The flies and the type of rubber legs and the type of woolly buggers they used and girdle bugs, it's very important. And I noticed the type of olive and brown woolly buggers that they wanted were the really good ones, basically. And they had a couple companies, but really only one that provided them in the quality they wanted. And it had a big, you know, longer hackles in the front towards the eye of the hook, a really nice clean marabou tail with a little bit of flash, but not too much. And I mean, more often than not, when a client or a group would come back in, and you could always tell when somebody got a big brown on the Yellowstone, it was almost always on one of those buggers. And I've seen it, and I'm, you know, you could throw rubber legs on it, cone heads, dumbbells, change your variations. And, you know, the bugger itself, it doesn't scale out too well beyond a 4 or a 2, but, you know, and I think that's where articulated flies start to have a ton of advantage when you start wanting to create a larger profile. And at first, you know, I think a lot of anglers see the 2 hooks, which, and they think that that's kind of an advantage of sorts. And the more you fish them, the more you know, your big browns almost always come on that front hook. And I don't, you know, and even steelhead fishing, you know, the stinger hook really got going 15 years ago, but a lot of those classic steelhead, I mean, the purple egg sucking leech is a woolly bugger, and you could try to outfish that fly if you want to, but it's going to be tough. So I guess, you know, and for a long time tying streamers, I was really using a lot of natural materials. And when I started dabbling with foam into streamers and started, you know, using synthetic hackles, and creating different contrast points within a fly that, you know, cause I could see like this woolly bugger, this olive woolly bugger with that, with the way a marabou tail looks and then the body transitions, you know, it really, it's very suggestive anatomically. It doesn't really look like anything, but it acts like everything, and it kind of looks like everything. And if you can get into a spot without spooking your fish, that fish has no reason to believe that it isn't a sculpin, or if you have it tied a different way, it isn't a crawdad or whatever it may be. And it's just a model of simplicity that is, you know, to this day, I mean, I talk about it in here as a bass fly and a brim fly. Half the locals fish an olive woolly bugger in a, you know, size to whatever fly rod they like to use.
Right.
And that's, you know, and obviously that's the same up in the north, and it's always cool to see new flies, but you can always learn a lot from the ones that have been working for generations.
Well, you're obviously a real student of the game in terms of fly design and presentation. You've turned that into a nice business for yourself. Can you tell me kind of about the genesis of the Dirty Water Fly Company?
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is, I was so lucky to have spent 15 seasons living in Montana. And man, we could travel, we could go to South America, we could go anywhere, but there's rivers up there and there's nowhere else like them in the world. And the ones that free flow still, the freestones and the upper portions of rivers that are dammed, they are very special. And the more you travel and the more you go around to places like Texas and Colorado and even Wyoming to a certain extent, the more you realize there's not a lot of rivers left that are intact. And spending, you know, I'm lucky enough to call the Yellowstone, the Jefferson, the Big Hole, the Missouri, all the upper Missouri watersheds, the Madison, all these great places. I was able to call those my home rivers for a long time. And each one of those rivers is so different. And the water that flows through them has a color to it. And in the spring, in April, May, June, when the snow melts coming down and the rivers are colored up and big and strong, and the bugs are going nuts. And if you're, you know, if you happen to be there for that and you hit those conditions right, it just does not, you know, you can't hardly put that into words until you really experience it. And that's where the name Dirty Water Fly Co. came, because if you, you know, when you first get into it, you think about all these trout streams and there's spring creeks and it's gin clear and the fish are huge and they're eating PMDs all day long. And, which there's certain, I mean, that is amazing stuff as well. But when you get to see these big rivers, and the, you know, Missoula couldn't be a better example of it. Two of the, you know, most amazing rivers combined in city limits, Bitterroot and the Clark Fork. And they both, that Clark Fork has a certain greenish color after Rock Creek dumps in, and up higher it has a tannic color from Warm Springs Creek and Racetrack Creek. And the Bitterroot has its own color. And you, I think, and I always, you know, you go now, social media has, man, it has grown fly fishing like wildfire. And it's funny because when I see people post images of trout out of Western Montana, I can almost always identify exactly what river it is by the watercolor.
Yeah, that's cool.
And whether it's the greenish emerald hues of the Yellowstone or the tannic colors of the Big Hole or that certain clear blue water of the Madison, and the Bitterroot has a tannic color too, depending on which feeder creek is putting in the most water. And, you know, and then the Missouri just has that slime. You know, it's kind of greasy, but it's so good. And it's fun to appreciate all that. And, you know, you can go and fish all over the place and you won't see that anywhere else. You literally have to go to somewhere like Patagonia where they're, you know, man hasn't quite reached out as far as they have in the Western United States and put a dam on every possible river. And we have plenty of tailwaters in Montana and dammed rivers that are amazing too, that, you know, as far as the industry is concerned, they are a huge part of it because they offer the consistency. And I think I love the concept of patience, planning a trip, understanding that some of the variables are out of your control. You plan a trip to go fish the Yellowstone or the Big Hole, and it could be in flood stage. Like, you could, like this year on the Bitterroot, you know, 8, 9, 10,000 CFS.
Oh yeah.
You might just show up and have to take it. Like, that's,
yeah, a lot of folks did in late June around here. They, it was real rugged conditions and things didn't come into shape until almost mid July.
Yeah. And it's, you know, as people in the industry, I think what defines the ones who are there are, you know, all the time is the appreciation for that. Even when it makes, like, as a guide, like in Missoula or Bozeman and all the rivers are in flood stage and the only place you really should be taking anybody is the Missouri, and you know there's going to be 100+ boats up there, it's tough. Yeah, you know, and fly shops are trying to make it happen, right? They got people from Dallas who booked, you know, last year, and they look at the Bitterroot and they're thinking, that looks pretty big. And you're thinking, yeah, it is. And we're going to have to pull out all the stops to make this, you know, a fun trip. But I think people do appreciate that about Montana. And, you know, it's, those are some big rivers. We saw the Yellowstone do what it did. You know, the Yellowstone reclaimed a lot of its river channel this year. I was lucky to be on it in May before the flooding and before kind of, you know, all the stars aligned to put a ton of snow up in the park and then followed by crazy heavy rain. And boom, we have a river that we've really not seen get to that scale.
Right, right. It's, yeah, it was a pretty incredible year and interesting to chat with the guides and the folks over there who said that, yeah, it's relatively back to normal for the most. I mean, that's what most of them are saying as far as the fishing's concerned. Like, you know, I kind of thought, oh, a little doom and gloom here. It was going to take many years for that fishery to recover, and they had lost entire age classes of fish. And I'm sure there's definitely some truth in that. But overall, it sounds like things are going to be okay on the Yellowstone.
Yeah, I mean, I think the next couple of years you're going to see I wouldn't necessarily say use the term record fishing, but fishing is going to be very good on the Yellowstone. All the fish that live in there, especially the way the browns are and the rainbow, like while it was for us above the river, you know, it looked crazy, but for them, that's every year to a certain extent. And it gets reshuffled every year. You look at the way the big brown trout in there. I mean, there's no fish that is as recognizable in Montana as a giant Yellowstone brown.
Right.
They have a certain look to them. They're a long fish.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about the Yellowstone and those browns. I was really kind of blown away when I first the first time I fished the Yellowstone was in the mid 90s, 1995. I went out to Bozeman for school, and my buddies that had already been out there had befriended some local guides. So, you know, they took us out and we floated the river right as soon as we got there for school. So hopper season, early September. And you could just throw a Turk's tarantula in the middle of the river in the heaviest current and fish would come up and eat it. And it was just unlike any place I had seen in that regard. Just, you know, to your point of where those fish will hold in that river, they can hold anywhere across that heavy current.
You know, current is one of the biggest tools that big trout use to feed, especially on, you know, whether it's bugs and like, let's say somewhere where there's a big back eddy and a foam bucket and it's picking up all the bugs, and whether the fish are feeding on emergers or nymphs or up on the surface, it's the current that's bringing the food there. And that's a little different concept, but for a big brown, they have a really big advantage in navigating that kind of water. And when they see a sculpin or a baby trout or whitefish elevated in the water column and heavy current, it's like knowing your cheeseburger is cooked perfectly and it's about to happen. They've got that down to a science there. I mean, some of those dry fly eats and current, you couldn't even if it was a foot deep, you could barely stand up.
Right.
It's so powerful. But that's where those fish are sitting. And it's pretty cool to see how they've developed that specific kind of style of feeding, especially later in the summer. And it, you know, you could prepare for it all you want, but eventually you're going to be in a really fast tail out that's really shallow and you're going to look away and then you're going to feel something and you look back and there's a, you know, 2 foot long brown trout trying to eat your Turk's tarantula or a Chernobyl ant, and you're asleep at the wheel because you didn't think there was any possible way that he could still be sitting out in this current.
Right.
And, you know, you're just thinking, you look over and there's a shark eating your giant foam bug and you're, you got a cold beverage in one hand and you're talking about something else with your buddy. And then, you know, maybe you get a, but a lot of times you're left there just to witness. Catching one of those
absolutely
really big browns is always just a special thing. And, you know, guys are getting, you know, using techniques that I don't think, you know, people are willing to do whatever it takes to catch those fish with a client more so nowadays, which I think is a natural development of fishing and guiding. And I think there's definitely some, you know, every guide is a little different and everybody kind of, you know, whether it's learning how to cast the fly rod in the morning so that we can have good dry fly fishing in the afternoon versus bobbering up and just rolling the bobber down the river all day. You know, and there's a different impact for each person using those different techniques and learning to cast a fly rod, and whether it's learning how to strip a streamer or drift a dry fly or whatever, you know, that's something that people, you know, we as industry folks can take it for granted because we're thinking about it all the time and working with it and doing that. But for a lot of new anglers, just the casting and the idea of presenting the fly is so intriguing that just making that one step. I mean, we've seen it. You have two boats go out and one boat is running, you know, a bugger and a soft tackle under a bobber or something, and the other boat's fishing a Royal Trout or a Turk's tarantula or some classic dry fly, and the people fishing the dry fly catch a 16-inch cutthroat or something, and it's like the greatest thing that's ever happened. And the other boat could be fishing the bobber and they could catch a bunch of big fish, but they won't have that same level of excitement as learning to cast a fly rod and presenting a dry fly and having a fish come up and eat it.
Right, right. So kind of getting back to the Dirty Water Fly Company here. So so it started out in Montana and as, you know, a custom tying operation. And now you've expanded and moved back to your roots in Texas and opened up a brick and mortar shop in Plano, correct?
This is correct. So we have the biggest little hole in the wall fly shop. Everything a person might need, from their first thread wrap on a hook to going and catching a fish. And we do fly tying every day. We have a big fly tying bench right front and center in the shop. Where I'm tying commercially, both for the shop and custom and everything like that. And we have a great local fly tying community. So they come in and we do classes and are excited about elevating that. And one of the main fundamentals of the shop is education based and having folks who, you know, just having an open door for somebody to come into and learn a little bit. And, you know, whether it's somebody who hasn't even thought about fishing or somebody who's fished their whole life using other techniques. And I've been very lucky to work with some of the best brands in fly fishing. And we're all of us industry folks are lucky to still be able to call and talk to somebody who designed the piece of gear or gear that's built in the U.S. You know, we carry anything from high performance stuff at an entry level price point to the finest, you know, the finest goods you can buy and a ton of fly tying stuff. And it's been really nice. It's a very laid back atmosphere. We have coffee. We do donuts on Saturdays. And the brands that I worked with at Creekside and the River's Edge, people I've known for decades, have been amazing and definitely could not have done that without them. And we try to carry as much American-made product as we can while still recognizing the need to get people out on the water at a little bit more of a budget. So we have flies tied by other American tires, including Hellfire Flies in Massachusetts, and Houston Fly Fishing, Danny Scarborough, local guide, who does some amazing warm water fishing and is a wonderful fly tire. Lee Blanton, Feather and Fly Outdoors, right here in the Metroplex. He does a lot of our classes and is a team member here. And he's just awesome. And we've got kind of an open bench policy, come down and tie. And people are pretty excited about that.
Well, it seems to me in the little bit of time that I've spent in Texas, that there is a ton of enthusiasm for fly fishing in that state, but maybe not a lot of resources for folks that are just trying to get into the sport. I remember I was interviewing Will from Brazos on the Fly for the podcast, and I don't know if you know him or not, but you know he was explaining to me how most of his clientele are just newbies that jump in the boat. And I said, man, isn't it hard to teach people how to fly fish, you know, right out of the gate from a boat in the wind? And he said, well, yeah, it really is. But there's really no other way to do it just because there's not as many resources here for newbies as there are in some other places like, you know, in Montana, for instance. So it sounds like your shop is really a resource for folks that are really interested in the sport and they have a place where they can go and kind of learn from the ground up.
Absolutely. And it has been, you know, the community has been amazingly supportive, and the local groups, people, you know, it's a big city. Dallas, Fort Worth's no joke. You know, it's like having a city from Livingston to Billings, Bozeman to Billings, you know, and having that. And it's so cool to talk to people about, you know, so many different things, the variety of fishing down here. You know, one angler's comes in and they've been fishing their little three weight for brim and occasionally a small bass. And then the next folks coming in is throwing, you know, nine weights for stripers on Lake Texoma. And then you got it's really cool. And I think that's really important for a lot of the new folks who are new to the idea of fly fishing in Texas, which is a pretty high percentage of our foot traffic are folks who just stopped in to be thinking, oh, I didn't really think about fly fishing down here. I know about, you know, out west in Colorado and Montana and stuff for trout and the clear rivers and all that. And they're really, whether they've bass fished or done any other type of fishing before, when they get to see that they could do whatever they were doing with their bait caster or spinning rod, but they could do it with a fly rod, it definitely sparks a lot of curiosity, and some of them really pick up right away and, you know, immediately start to recognize it. And I think that's why we're seeing it being so popular down here. It's easy to get gear. You could, you know, we down here, you know, there aren't a lot of fly shops. And the ones that are here are very, you know, connected with the community, and they're spread out, you know, in Bozeman. I think 7 or 8 fly shops in Bozeman, 5 in Missoula.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, Texas, like true full service fly shops, like, you know, not necessarily like travel or apparel and stuff. We're gluttonous in Montana. There's so many great fly shops. Down here in Texas, you know, there isn't as many because there isn't the fisheries on the fly fishing to really generate that kind of like outfitting and destination travel. There really has been an amazing amount of support for somebody to come in and realize, okay, this is a fly shop. They have flies, fly tying stuff, and fly tackle, and a few other oddities and things you might need on the water. And, you know, right here we have a number of Orvis stores. We've got some big box stores who carry fly fishing stuff. We've got a couple other really cool fly shops right in the Metroplex, you know, and there's been a really good amount of acceptance and support for being able to come in and just talk fishing and not have to worry about anything else, whether you just want to learn a little bit about a fly or whatever it could be, or you're going fishing or headed out west or going on a trip. And very, very happy to be down here. It's an honor to represent the brands and to keep doing something that I've been passionate about in fly shops, which is getting people out there on the water themselves.
Well, awesome, man. Good on you. Circling back to topwater bass fishing. How do you set the hook when a bass eats your topwater bug?
Well, in a perfect world where you have a pretty good idea of when the magic is about to happen, a pure strip set is invaluable. You can't make up that kind of power with a direct strip set like you would in saltwater fishing. And bass have a bony mouth. They have larger bones that you need a little wider gap hook. And they're a fish that you don't get to let them run, or even trout fishing to a certain extent. You hook a nice one and you let them swim around out there. There's no doing that with bass. You're going right into the trees. She's going back to the stump she lives under. So that strip set and like the topwater concept is one of the most important fundamentals of the big picture with bass fishing with a fly rod, is that you've gotten that fish both to eat and to expose itself and get it out of the cover at the same time. Now, because you don't know when it's going to happen, and you're not always in perfect position to execute a strip set, you know, which I think is probably the toughest thing with bass fishing. Whereas, like, I've dealt with a lot of really good saltwater anglers. They can cast 70 feet into a, you know, a Coors Light can. But they really rely on that visual, you know, like a bonefish. You see it swimming over, you know, sometimes you can't see it and it's really hard. But you do know that the fish is there, and you know when it's likely to happen, when they're going to eat. With bass, you got nothing. You're just fishing. You're in the blind 100%. And at any point, the water could just erupt. And that is so much fun. Even when it doesn't work out, you still got to witness, right? When you're out of position and you decided you wanted to twitch the fly with the rod a little bit, or you were, you know, looking over at your buddy, and, you know I have made my fair share of prayer hook sets for largemouth with the rod and just trying to recover slack with as much strip as possible. But sometimes you're just not in position and you got to find a way, and it doesn't always work out, but it is really fun. That element of surprise, it makes the strip set super challenging. And some days you seem to have it. Some days when the fly lands, you're already in position. You make your strips and the fish are kind of working with your rhythm. And then other days, it seems like right when you start to strip, a big one comes up and blows it up. And you can't quite nail it right there. And you just get a piece of them. And then, you might have another day where right when you pause it and you're letting it sit so they can come up and eat it, they do. And it goes by the book. But there's, it's a challenge, no doubt about it. It's a lot of fun. And sometimes you're fishing short range. Sometimes you're fishing long range. We've got a bunch of little creeks down here. We've got big rivers. We've got reservoirs. We got ponds, and a variety of food sources. That topwater element, so much fun.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest parts, muscle memory wise, coming from a, dry fly troutish background. When you get that topwater eat on the bass, if you lift the rod like a grasshopper eat or something, you're probably going to miss that fish. It's interesting because I haven't necessarily had that crossover problem that a lot of folks do when they go bone fishing for the first time, just because I've done a fair number of streamer fishing. So I don't have that rod lift issue, but when I go from trout to bass, I undoubtedly miss my first several topwater eats. Because I don't apply the proper hook set, whether, it's a straight on strip set or a strip set to one side or the other. But that rod lift is a killer in my experience. So interesting to kind of hear you verify that.
Yeah. And even fishing out west for big trout, and I've been lucky. I've fished with some of the most incredible anglers, and everybody has a little different system and a little different techniques, and they each have pros and cons, dangers and challenges, or at least, if you start, and I know a lot of great anglers who use their rod to move their fly a lot, and I see what kind of flies they like to use, and they're usually flies with not necessarily two hooks, but with maybe a lighter wire hook, because that rod, if your rod's out sideways and a fish strikes, you just don't have anything with a strip set, so you're going to try to use the rod. Fly rods are typically 9 feet long and can be literally doubled over, so that shock absorption is a tool, but it can also be a hindrance. And with bass fishing, you really don't have any room for error. You don't want to really lift that rod until you're dead to screws tight to them.
Right.
And I certainly have I like to start with a very hard strip set and go back with my body, and not necessarily lifting the rod tip, but pulling the butt up and towards me has been an effective technique.
Okay.
Because no matter what, even on almost pure glass water, you've got to eliminate that slack to get tight to the hook, to set the hook. And anything you can do that while maintaining tension to the fly is very helpful. And that's, the adage of rod tip down when you're stripping and retrieving your fly is very important, because it gives you that direct connection to the fly.
Yeah, what you said about slack reminds me of the adage of the Hayward Fly Fishing Company, which those guys do a ton of topwater stuff for smallmouth, and their slogan is "slack is evil." And yeah. If you come from a trout fishing background, that doesn't make any sense to you. But if you go topwater smallmouth fishing with those guys, then you get it. Or topwater bass fishing anywhere. So, awesome, man. Your website is dirtywaterflyco.com, and how best can folks get in touch with you, Dan, to learn more about your business and your fly patterns?
Yeah, well, the website is a great way to do that. We just completed a remodel that allowed us to have our, going from just a commercial fly tying operation and materials distribution to a full-fledged fly and tackle shop, we had to make some adjustments, but we're pretty happy with navigation, and using the website is really good. You can find us on Instagram at dirtywaterflyco. You can email me anytime at dan@dirtywaterflyco.com. Check out, give me a call, send me a text, 406-600-6732. And no question should be feared. Feel free to ask away. And we do try to help folks connect the dots as much as possible and let them get out there on the water. And been very fortunate to work with so many great folks in the industry. And that's something that certainly has made it all work and worthwhile. And the folks in the industry and the folks who don't even know they're about to be a fly angler, you know, and everybody in between.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spin, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.